Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, aka the Kalika Warrior Party. And to anyone else who wants to join the party and who cares and dares to listen, this is your navigator, John Lash, recording at 4:30 a.m. on Saturday, the 23rd of February, 2013. This is NAB Briefing 53, the third under the title Mephisto Rules. I just finished loading the previous talk and thought you might like to know what's happening in my time and setting. It's been raining torrentially here all night, on and off. It's absolutely deafening. And this is, of course, wonderful because the rain of Andalusian winter replenishes the land. It fills the aquifers. It drenches the arroyos, the roots of the carob trees, the wild olives, and the oaks. And so it assures a glorious spring when the entire countryside of the Serenia Duranda is decked out with the most magnificent flowers, massive banks and beds of gold, yellow, and blue, and white flowers, and the odor of the gorse here, the odor of the thorn bush, the gorse, is like a honeysuckle, and it wafts through the air with an intoxicating odor. And so, such are the transmutations of this beautiful planet. As I stand here in the middle of the night with my two faithful companions, Rumi's looking right up at me right now as I'm talking, and Nikki's elegantly sprawled out on the bed. In this winter night, in the darkness and the rain, the intoxicating aromas and the erotic thrills of springtime are being alchemically prepared. In one season, she prepares the elixirs for another season. And in fact, in the Andromedan view of our life on this planet, there is nothing but a continual succession of elixirs. The seasons are elixirs. And the Dakini wisdom, which often takes the form of rain, is also a powerful elixir, as you know. Anyway, I just want to report for all of you listening to me currently and for generations to come that at 4:19 a.m. today, I wrote down a name. I wrote it down. I had this name in my mind, if you want to use that quaint expression, for a few days now. And yet I didn't write it down until 4:19 this morning. And then I went on the internet to look up a particular reference that might be associated with this name. So I was looking under the subject of the kings of Shambhala and other arcane material relating to the mythology and the folklore behind Tibetan Buddhism. So as I was looking at a certain image that came up, one of the kings of Shambhala, about 3 minutes after I wrote down this name, a thunderbolt shook this house like nothing that I have ever seen or felt as in the 5 years I've been living in this place. I have seen some fantastic displays of thunder and lightning, I can tell you that. One of them, I think it was in the spring of 2007, when I was head over heels in my sexual and romantic addiction with Emma. One of them at that time, I remember calling her, came from Africa. I saw it coming over the horizon, over the Atlas Mountains, and I watched it arrive. And that was certainly the most spectacular thunder and lightning rainstorm I've ever seen in my life. There was something about the power of that storm in 2007. Something about something about the display of the power that presented itself in such a way that when the lightning flashed, you saw the entire sky right in front of the house, right in front of your face, and all the way out to the horizon, full of suspended raindrops like diamonds. Just flash frozen in that moment. Huge, huge elixir raindrops. So something similar is happening here right now. And there was, as I was writing down this name, the rain suddenly came on. I thought it was going to just flood the house, but my house doesn't leak. And I have the window of the writing studio open. It's warm inside, but I can look out at the rain. And then at the moment, 3 minutes after I wrote this name down, there was a thunderbolt that sounded like it was inside a cavern. It sounded like really, really deep piano chords magnified a million times. It had that rumble in it that you can feel right at the back of your teeth, in your wisdom teeth, or where they used to be. It goes right into the cavities of your wisdom teeth. It's this deep, deep, penetrating rumble. And I hear a slight rumble on the horizon as I'm speaking now. And that happened 3 minutes after I wrote down the name Rigdon Labro. The name is Rigdon Labro. R-I-G-D-U-N L-A-B-R-O. That's a name to conjure with. And I propose that you and the GNE and the Calico Warrior Party conjure with this name. Don't be put off because it's Tibetan. It's the last Tibetan name you're going to hear. It's the last one you'll ever need to know. It could be the last one you ever say. But say it. Rigdon Labro. This is the name to conjure with. This is the name for conjuring and invoking the Kalki Kali Tulpa of the Aeon Sophia. And needless to say, I don't have to say this, because it's obvious, but I say it because it gives me pleasure. The proof and evidence that this name is true is just exactly what I just described, isn't it? So, on that note, let's return to the theme of Mephisto rules. Now, actually, the title of these ongoing briefings in opening series, the 50 series, could be as well Matangi rules. You know, Matangi rules for Kalika warfare, Matangi rules for strategy. So consider them interchangeably. In addition to the two rules I stated in NB 52, I now add a further qualification This is an essential point of the initial strategy of engagement. You need to be crystal clear that the Aeon Sophia does not need the command of any human animal to achieve her tulpa. But she needs human command once she has achieved it. Are you clear on that? This is imperative intel. She is preparing her tulpa as I speak. And in the NAB briefing entitled The Revelation of Her Method, I explained exactly how she does so. I want to take a moment to tell you exactly how I was able to offer that explanation. As some of you might already guess, I can offer that explanation because I went into the Nahual and found it. I saw what she's doing in the Nahual. That's exactly true. As I said when I presented the explanation, the revelation of her method, cannot be conceived in an ordinary state of mind, cannot be detected in ordinary consciousness, but only in non-ordinary consciousness. But once it is so detected, it can be articulated, and then it becomes something you can hold in ordinary consciousness. So yes, I was in the Nahual when I detected the revelation of her method, but I wasn't in there alone. And in fact, it was Kundry who spoke that explanation. She actually spoke it to me. But at the moment that she spoke it, she didn't have her own mind. Nor did I have mine. So at that moment, we both had the mind of the Nahual. And it so happened that in the conversation we enjoyed at that moment, in the high pleasure and delight and privilege of that conversation, she verbally articulated the revelation of her method. This has happened before to me. As a matter of fact, in the case of the Dakini instructions of Kalatantra, those instructions came in a zip file in the download of Planetary Tantra, as you know. But the unzipping of those instructions, in some cases, occurred in solitude. That is to say, I was alone and on my own. But in another instance, the unzipping of the terma occurred in the presence of a woman. So last weekend, Kundry and I took an excursion into the Nahual. It was first-time excursion for her, according to the particular tools we used, that is to say, the support and guidance of a genial species. I must say, she handled it beautifully. It's a wonderful thing for the Nahual to see the talent in a neophyte. And it reassures me a lot in my conviction that shamanic practices in Planetary Tantra are easy and proceed rapidly. There's no trial, there's no ordeal, there's no necessity to face demons or to be afraid. We have what I call the beauty option. Go straight to beauty. And that's where she wants us to go. You might recall that I did a shamanic session last spring here at the house with a crew member, Stephanie, and we asked a question about the correct use of psychoactive plants and sacred plant teachers in Sophia's correction. And she said, use them to take people to the beauty, and I'll take it from there. And so I had a great demonstration of how that works. And I would be delighted if I could indulge myself for a moment and recite to you a little nursery rhyme that came to my mind. This is not the original version of the nursery rhyme. It's slightly modified. I modified this nursery rhyme, and I sang it to Kundry as we were coming out of our session, our seance, our excursion into the Nahual. And I recited this little nursery rhyme with my slight modification in the last line in order to recognize her achievement and to honor and celebrate her experience. And the little rhyme goes like this. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider and sat down beside her and carried Miss Muffet away. Some of you who've read the incomplete memoir, if you want to call it that, my account of mystical experiences that led me to the recognition of the organic light, Severed Rose. You'll find it in the Planetary Tantra section of metahistory.org. Those of you who've read that know that I have described in quite palpable and explicit detail the sensations and the impressions everyone has, and it is the same for everyone, upon witnessing and interacting with the organic light, which is the primary substance body of the Aeon Sophia. And I describe various properties of the light, such as the cool melon feel it has on your skin. There are other effects as well that I haven't described yet in those four installments of Severed Rose. One effect was strongly evident in this session Kundry and I had at Ambergain. I would call this the filamentation of the light. When you are actually comfortable enough in cognitive ecstasy, in the state of cognitive ecstasy induced by these psychoactive plants, when you're really, really comfortable, you're able to feel that the organic light comes and surrounds you. It actually embraces you, and it's all around you physically. And when it comes up close to your body, you can get the impression, and everyone does, it's natural, that you have something like a spider web or a thread floating on your face. So there's a tendency to reach up and try to brush it away from your brow, or, you know, especially on your cheeks. You feel on your cheeks the wispy, delicious play of filaments. And there's a tendency to think that maybe some particle of thread or part of a spider's web has dislodged itself and is floating through the air and has brushed against your face. It's a delightful feeling. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey. The organic light is like curds and whey. It has a nougat or whey-like texture, and it curdles, it roils inwardly with a sweet, soft movement, a soft, roiling movement, like a curdling of the light. It's exquisitely beautiful. Along came a spider and sat down beside her and carried Miss Muffet away. So the traditional line says, and frightened Miss Muffet away. But Kundry wasn't frightened, and nor would anyone else be in their right mind, because there's nothing to be frightened of, and there's nothing to fear in the entire universe. So there we were, having a chat, and acutely, deliciously aware of the play of mycelia filaments of the organic light, mycelia filaments, tendrils, all over the body, but particularly on the face. And after a few minutes, when you get it, you don't reach up anymore and try to brush it away. Along came the spider. And so in that state, we were discussing the single most important subject of this planet, which is the seventh identical node in the lucid dreaming of the Aeon Sophia. And we were talking about how she's going to achieve that tulpa, how she is actually going to create her tulpa. What method is she using? And it was in Kundry's words that the revelation of her method was first spoken in this world on a wintry evening in February in Andalusia, Spain. And all I did as the Nawal was polish it up a little bit. Remember that the role of the Nawal is twofold: to provide syntax and to steady the approach to the unknown. And the gift of the Nawal is freedom. So as a Nawal, I simply put what Kundry said. I hardly had to change a word of it, actually, but I just put it into a cogent and coherent syntax. And that is the syntax, the expression I delivered in NAB Briefing 50, the revelation of her method. So, to return to the figure of Mephisto, let's see how we can put the trickster in perspective to the coming tulpa of the Aeon Sophia, and in turn put those two elements in perspective of the Kalika War formation, the Kalika Battle formation, if you want to call it that. Let's picture ourselves standing in the ranks of the Kalika warrior party. We always place ourselves behind those three warrior witches who are standing there with their arms interlocked. Kali central, Matangi on the right, and Kurukul on the left. So we are facing their backs. We have their back. Okay, we have their back. And they lead. They are in the avant-garde of the engagement. And what do we see looking out at the battlefield? Who actually is out there? Who are the adversaries involved here, and how do we picture them? Well, it's quite simple, really. The battle for the sanity of the Anthropos and the safety of all living beings is a battle against three forces. One is Mephisto, who is actually installed and operating within the human psyche itself, the enemy within, the trickster. Second are the Archons, who are operating from beyond the earth, from an extraterrestrial zone, and intruding upon the earth psychically and operating as mind parasites. And then there are the enemies of humanity, as I call them, the human vermin. And they are actually human animals. And those three, in totality, represent the threat to this divine experiment. It's as simple as that. Now you might say, well, what about Melchizedek? Well, Melchizedek isn't a threat any more than Howdy Doody. You know, Melchizedek doesn't do anything. Melchizedek is an archontic simulacrum, a fake used to persuade people and used to enlist people into the insanity of their agenda, which is a no agenda. So the archons have produced Melchizedek. And some of the enemies of humanity have met Melchizedek or heard about that entity. And they are very impressed by this Melchizedek character. Of course, you're not impressed by Melchizedek, are you? And neither am I. Melchizedek has the power of a Mickey Mouse statue in a wax museum. Got it? Nevertheless, Melchizedek does have a kind of power. The very presence of Melchizedek on this earth is an unfortunate thing for the divine experiment, that's for sure. Melchizedek does represent a great triumph of the archons. And not only does Melchizedek allow the archons to convince people that they can achieve a similar state of clone-like immortality, the very presence of Melchizedek creates a lot of insanity, propagates a lot of insanity in the human mind. I just received an email from a crew member, Michael, describing to me a process developed at the University of New Mexico in which researchers coat a living cell with silica armor, creating a near-identical inorganic duplicate. This is archonic replication, of course. The so-called zombie cell technique has the potential for building complex nanoscale machines using life as a blueprint. And he goes on to describe this gruesomely ridiculous and stupid process. Vast scientific teams at the Sandia Laboratories in Albuquerque, not far from where I used to live, are now engaged in this ridiculous project, along with these other immortalist projects that are going on around the planet. Now, a lot of it, you know, is just for money. People do anything for a buck. These scientific experts are hopeless and useless animals. They cannot make a tuna fish sandwich. And yet there they are in the laboratories replicating the structures of life on the nanometer scale. And for what? For what purpose? They can't do anything that practically addresses the real problems on this planet, such as, say, chemical pollution from manufacturing plants. They can't do anything about that, but they can go into the laboratory and create zombie cells. So all of this kind of research, including transhumanism in all of its aspects, is part of the insanity that you could say is perversely inspired in the human mind by the very presence of Melchizedek on this planet. Because even if you don't see Melchizedek and you don't know what that icon represents, the Melchizedek concept is there. And it's the source of a lot of depraved behavior in the scientific world and absolutely equally as well in the religious world, as we know from the Zadokim cult, and equally as well in the world of art and music and entertainment. You could say that the depersonalization of the human animal and the plastification of the human animal in the media and in art and entertainment is inspired by the presence of Melchizedek. So although Melchizedek has no real power, the power of illusion operates in full force through this icon. I wouldn't even call it an entity. It's an icon. It's a puppet. It's a howdy doody puppet manipulated by the archons. So we're not fighting Melchizedek. Melchizedek can be completely neutralized by the lack of slaughter on this planet, as I've explained. The shedding of human blood produces a chemical, which I have yet to identify. Maybe some of you can get onto this for me. A chemical that reacts in the atmosphere, and that produces an effect upon the Melchizedek simulacrum, similar to the effect of sniffing paupers. And through that weird procedure, the archons achieve the illusion that Melchizedek can actually breathe. I mean, it is so perverse and absurd and gruesomely stupid that you really have to take a few steps back and register how awful this is. Nevertheless, we do not fight Melchizedek in this battle. We engage Mephisto by learning to see the Mephisto rules using the Matangi eye. And we engage the archons and resist and defeat the archons as the Gnostics advised us to do. And I've written about that, Kundalini and the alien force, and so on. Finally, there's the question of the enemies of humanity, defining who they are exactly. That's coming up in this series of briefings inspired by Matangi instruction. Just a quick point of clarification there on dealing with the archons. It's important to realize that the greater part of the damage archons have done to the divine experiment is way, way beyond our control. We are self-correcting animals, but we cannot correct something that extrapolates beyond the scale of correction. And this is the case with human behaviors and forms of thinking that have been manipulated by the archons. So, as I said at the beginning of the GNE, Vivi herself takes down those archonic structures. They're too massive, too elaborate for us to do anything with on a one-to-one basis. Imagine the labyrinthine complexity of the Ottoman Empire, which, by the way, was populated by a particularly vicious breed of human vermin who happened to love sadism and torture to a very high degree. The Ottoman Empire was an example of what human vermin can do when they are allowed to play their Kafkaesque games. And of course, the continuation of the Ottoman Empire continues in the world today in some respects. It's not entirely over. But you can leave it to Vivi to collapse those structures. Look at what she's doing as I speak with the Catholic Church and the hierarchical, patriarchal domination system of Roman Catholicism. But you and I, and every human animal, every individual animal, has a responsibility to immunize yourself against psychic intrusion by the archons. Study Wilhelm Reich. Learn about the repression of libido. Learn about the genital embrace, the function of the orgasm. and learn about the connection between genitality, as Reich called it, the streaming of erotic sensations in the body, the connection between that and immunity to psychic intrusion, and that's all you have to know. So you seal your own aura against archonic intrusion through sexual and erotic pleasure, and through the pleasure of surrender you may also have in the presence of the natural world. Surrender to the beauty of the natural world insulates you against archontic intrusion. It's as simple as that. And as far as the larger affairs of the archons go, we leave that to VV, don't we? So at this point in the process of Sophia's correction, in the critical 3-year period of initialization, there's a moment when Matangi instruction comes into play. It's truly remarkable that 2 Matangi shifts have occurred in the opening months of 2013. And in the second part of this briefing, I'm going to return specifically to some points of observation and some strategic insights of Matangi regarding how Mephisto works. I've spoken about still photos and the difference between a still photo that accurately represents the subject of the photograph, such as a butterfly or the waterfall at Yosemite Park, and a photograph whose contents are faked or photoshopped, to use the current term. Every time you look at an advertisement poster, especially, for instance, consider those advertisement posters that show Mr. Clean, the tulpa of Mr. Clean, or some other Smurf-like creature floating over a box of cereal, pictured on the kitchen table with a 4-year-old child who has been dressed up and has makeup and has his hair arranged in a certain way, and every single detail of the clothes he's wearing and the kitchen table has all been faked and arranged. Consider a photograph of that. Those kind of still photos that are faked, photoshopped, and orchestrated leave macula. They leave blind spots in your field of perception. And eventually humans get to the point where you can show them a fake photo and they don't know it's faked. Of course, we're there, aren't we? And we've been there for quite a while. So I won't run that subject into the ground, although there's a lot to learn from studying how photography affects human perception for the worse and how it affords advantage to the archons. Let me just give you a general indication that you can detect Mephisto rules, the rules by which Mephisto operates, in society whenever you have that uncanny feeling that some unwritten law is in effect. Mephisto rules through unwritten rules, unwritten laws. And these unwritten laws, to a large degree, account for the insane conformity of the human herd. Many experiments have been conducted to investigate how one human being, one human animal in a group, will voluntarily conform to what the group is doing by some unspoken rule. Conformity is one of Mephisto's greatest assets, and yet it's not really in his bag of tricks. Conformity is a tendency of the human animal, and he tends to exploit that tendency to an extreme degree. And you can tell when Mephisto is doing this Because you get an uncanny or uncomfortable or puzzled feeling and a kind of question forms in your mind. It's like, why is this happening like this? I mean, like, what is the rule? Let me give you an example. I'll give you three examples. Muzak, M-U-S-A-K. When shopping malls were created back, who knows when, I guess that would be post-World War II, this was a great triumph for the Archons, because shopping malls are nothing more than parade grounds for zombies, consumer zombies, who just buy things that they see other people buying. So conformity and imitation prevail in the shopping mall. What René Girard called mimetic desire. People don't even know what they want. They don't know what they desire. They ask them what is their highest desire. They don't even know what their lowest desire is. And so people operate on what René Girard called mimetic desire. They want something because somebody else wants it. And there's no original wanting anywhere. If you ask, well, who is the first person who wanted this? Who is the first person who wanted, a Barbie doll? Well, there was no first person who ever wanted a Barbie doll. There was the campaign to make Barbie dolls as a product to sell to people, because corporations operate by selling things to consumers that consumers don't want. And so the Barbie doll was invented purely to be sold, to be consumed. And then a photograph was taken of a child playing with a Barbie doll, which planted in the mind of children the idea that somebody, some child, wanted a Barbie doll, but that was a fake. But once the desire was planted, then little Susie or little Marilyn went out and insisted on having a Barbie doll. And then when she was coming home, every young child who saw her with a Barbie doll wanted what she had. This is the infection. This is the contagion of mimetic desire, which again is not a trick of Mephistopheles, of Mephisto. It is a terrible tendency of the human animal, unfortunately, that very quickly gets out of control. And Mephisto exploits this tendency. So I was talking about Muzak rather than shopping malls, but I had to introduce the shopping mall scenario. Okay, now what happens when you go into a shopping mall? Well, there's always music playing, and this is called Muzak. Muzak is the name for the music that is pumped into shopping malls, stores, elevators, buses, train stations, bus stations, cafes. And for some time now, human beings live in the continual presence of Muzak. This is a Mephisto rule. You must have Muzak. If you go back and try to find out who was the first person who ever wanted to have music playing in the background all the time, I'm not talking about people in the corner playing a little band or someone with a guitar singing. I'm not talking about the real presence of music produced by a human animal. I'm talking about a broadcast background music, Muzak. If you try to go back and find the first moment when anyone wanted that, you won't find it. No one ever fucking wanted it. No one ever wanted it. And no one wants it today, not really. But try to get someone to stop it. I have almost gotten in fights in cafes in London when I asked the waitress or the manager to turn off the music because I was the only person in the cafe. Not fights, because of course the British wouldn't fight unless, they were drunk. But real hostility expressed to me, because I simply said, if another customer comes in, you can turn on the music, but turn it off as long as I'm the only one here. Oh, no, no, no. Why does there have to be music playing all the time? That is a Mephisto rule. It's an unwritten rule. And people conform to the unwritten rule. It's mindlessness. Mephisto loves it. He plays with our mindlessness and our conformity and uses it against us. That's part of his perverse his perverse enjoyment, his perverse gratification. Another example, the advertising voice. Just listen to any clip, you know. Sometimes when you play a YouTube clip, first there's an advertisement that comes on. You get the opportunity to cut it off in 5 seconds if you want. It usually runs about 15 or 19 seconds. Just sit there and listen to an advertising clip and listen to the voice. First of all, there's generally music in the background of the clip, isn't there? So, for instance, if it's a clip with Andy, the American actress, I think her name is Andy McDowell, advertising some cosmetic. The clip starts, and the first thing you hear is what? Music. Why? Okay. The second thing that you hear is the advertising voice of a woman selling you a cosmetic, or the advertising voice of a man selling you a car, or selling you car insurance, or the advertising voice of a woman or a man selling you chocolate cake mix, or selling you dishwashing detergent. And just listen to that voice. And try to imagine that if you were standing, say, on the street somewhere, in a town or city, maybe at a bus stop or something, you're just standing there out in public, and someone walked up to you and started to address you in the voice that is used for these advertising voiceovers. How creepy would that be? I can tell you honestly that if anybody ever, by some weird fluke, came up to me and addressed me in the voice that an advertiser uses, I think I would just punch them out right on the spot. I don't think I would be able to resist a violent reaction. It is so disgusting to be addressed in this manner. The same applies for the voice that is used by the talking heads of news programs, you know, the evening news, the way they talk to people on the news. If someone talked to you that way in real life, you would feel insulted. It is so condescending. Now, you might say, John, don't lay this at the feet of Mephisto. What does this have to do with Mephisto tactics? We know that advertising is a science. Teams of people put these things together. And undoubtedly, people who do voiceovers for advertisements undergo vocal training. They're coached on how to talk. It's all being done deliberately and systematically. And I agree, that's true. But let me ask you, who said that it had to be done that way? Who established those rules that a voiceover of an ad must talk to you in this terribly slimy way that is both ingratiating and condescending and soothing and persuasive at the same time? You know, the Greeks had their rhetoric, is what they called it. The sophists used rhetoric, and I can tell you, because I remember very well, that I would at the verge of punching a few of them out as well. Because this tone of rhetoric, this persuasive, slimy, ingratiating, condescending, patronizing tone is really repulsive to the human animal. And yet think of how much of that you are exposed to in this world, according to the Mephisto rule, which is an unwritten rule that is the way it ought to be done, and also an unwritten rule that you're not supposed to react, that you're not supposed to object to it being done that way. These are Mephisto rules. And once you see these rules operating, with the Matangi eye, you cut it off right at that point. The Matangi eye cuts off the effect of what you're perceiving. And so, by that perception, augmented by Matangi, any human animal can quite rapidly disengage him or herself from the treacherous enmeshment of these devices of persuasion. Another example, and this is really a blatant one, is the example of drills. Now remember, a drill is a simulation. And simulations remind us of the archons, right? The archons work through simulation. Now, do you notice how much that you hear about drills in the world today? Almost constantly. And also, if you study the 9/11 event and the London bombing, you know that they were associated with drills that were happening at the time. Drills that were replicating the actual real events, and the confusion of that situation was immense. Some of the people in the air traffic control system in the United States did not know, and in the military, in the NORAD, they did not know if they were responding to a drill or a real situation. Since 9/11, there has been so much emphasis on drills. Drills, drills, drills. And there, why do we do drills? Well, I'll tell you why. There's a good reason. Because, for instance, if you belong to a crew of a firehouse, and you're going to be fighting different kinds of fires, well, let's say you're going to be fighting a fire in a chemical factory. Well, that's not the same in a paint factory as fighting a fire in a home. So there are special conditions involved with a fire in a paint factory. So wouldn't it be a good idea if we took the team and we simulated a fire in a paint factory and we put the firemen through a drill so that they would learn how to deal with those conditions? Then, when and if a real fire happens in a paint factory, the firemen will be better prepared, won't they? Will they? Who came up with the idea that doing these drills makes people better prepared to meet the real event that would correspond to the drill? Is that in fact true? It's an unseen rule that that is true, and it's an unseen rule that drills are necessary. We must do drills. And so, look at the news. A good part of what you hear in the mainstream news is about military drills. Oh, the police are on the road. They're performing a drill. They're performing an exercise of preparedness. They're performing a drill for a school shooting, a possible massacre like happened at Sandy Hook. Or was that just a drill? We've gone so far into this madness about drills that it's impossible to tell if Sandy Hook was a drill or an actual massacre. Or maybe it was a drill that turned into a massacre. Or maybe it was a massacre that turned into a drill. I mean, it's impossible to know. This is how far you get into the madness of Mephisto when you follow unspoken and unseen rules, and when you don't question those rules. So the Mephisto rules are always unwritten rules. The written rules are written down by the enemies of humanity. For instance, the PNAC document, Project for a New American Century, Opposition Northwoods, the white papers of the neocons of the United States government are rules for enslavement, deception, and domination of the American people that are written down. Those are not Mephisto rules. The Mephisto rules are dangerous and tricky and subtle and ambiguous because they are not written down, and yet people follow them. So using the Matangi eye involves, to a large degree, simply detecting these unwritten rules. And at the moment you detect, you detach from that rule. I wanted to give you just one last example of something that happened recently that, again, is an instance of behavior in the mainstream that depicts the Mephisto rules. One of the problems with the reporting in the mainstream, and equally so with the reporting of individual investigators on the internet, is that they say, the report says, that something is going to be done, but they don't say who said it's going to be done. me give you an example. Recently, there was a news report on RT that said that the Smithsonian Institute, get ready for this. Did you hear this? The Smithsonian Institute, Smithsonian, the largest and most predictive, prestigious archive of files in the United States, files and historical records, is going to preserve all the tweets made by American citizens. All of the tweets made by American citizens starting from a certain period of time, going some years back, I think, since the beginning of Twitter, are going to be saved at the Smithsonian. Did you know that? Now, that's a report, a news report. And what is maddening about this report is not only the total and complete inanity of such an action, but what is really maddening about it is that the report doesn't say who says that the Smithsonian is going to do this. It doesn't say who decided. It doesn't say there was a meeting of the president and the board of blah, blah, blah of the Smithsonian Institute, and here they are, and here are their names, and here are their faces, and these six individuals sat in a room, and when they came out of the meeting, they announced to the news agencies that the Smithsonian is going to save all the tweets that the Americans have tweeted since Twitter began. But they never tell you that. 99 out of 100, probably 999 out of 100 times, when you hear a news report, and even in the alternative media, although it's a little better, that says something is going to be done, they don't say who said so. They don't say where it originates, with whom it originates, who made the decision. Now, you might think that's a simple omission. There must have been somebody in the organization of the Smithsonian who made this decision, you know, the president, the director, or whatever. And it's true, probably in some cases, you could trace an event back to an individual person. But I assure you that in some cases, you won't be able to. It gets back to the web of complicity and collusion that the trickster weaves in human society. No matter how much you investigate the Oklahoma City bombing to detect and expose the complicity, you will never be completely satisfied because there is always an irreducible and irrational element. No matter how much I would learn if I went to investigate how it comes about that the Smithsonian is going to save all these tweets, at the end of the day, there would be something that could not be explained. That is the supernatural element of trickery. That is the rule of Mephisto. And you get an idea, I think you may get an idea from the descriptions that I'm giving, of how extensive this is and how it creates a massive encumbering web of collusion that ultimately is mad. It's insane. Because collusion and conformity go together like two twisted Siamese twins joined at the hips. Collusion and conformity. And this is the trickery of Mephisto. So know the enemy. Because Mephisto propagates and engenders an atmosphere of collusion and conformity in the world, the true enemies of humanity have an enormous advantage upon the world. They operate inside that web of collusion and complicity and conformity, because conformity is complicity. They operate inside that web with impunity. It's like an enormous system of funny house mirrors and smoke and mirrors and snakes and ladders that allows them to hide. Because bear in mind that the enemies of humanity operate through secrecy and deception. And if they did not hide, they would not be able to perpetrate their evil upon this planet. So there it is, some strategic profiles, if you will, regarding the rules of Mephisto, the unspoken rules. One of the places in the world today where Mephisto really, really entertains himself is, of course, in the TSA security checks. I've explained before that the event that happens in a TSA security check is an event of pretending or make-believe. You, the traveler, on your way from one place to another, are not merely required to reveal what is in your bag, are not merely required to reveal what is on your body. Those are simple physical acts of disclosure. You are required to pretend that you could be something that you definitely are not. And so it's that act of pretending that really defines the insane and insidious nature of the TSA security theater. But there is a real Mephisto element at play here, because people follow an unseen rule, don't they? They follow a number of unseen rules. If you question the rule, you don't want to follow it anymore. If you question the rule that says you are required to pretend that you are a terrorist, who invented that rule, you see? And who enforces that rule? And why do they enforce that rule? So if you recognize the rule, at least you have the option not to follow the rule. And of course, in some cases, we know, because of the way this game is set up, you can find yourself directly confronting one of the enemies of humanity or one of the hired thugs of the enemies of humanity if you question that rule. So I say that we in Kalika warfare follow a rule of thumb that all warriors follow. Choose your battles carefully. Don't choose to engage a thug at a TSA checkpoint unless you're ready to handle that thug and you know how you're going to handle that thug. But you can go through that experience with your eyes open and unclouded by the mist of Mephisto. You can go through these experiences. Unfortunately, sometimes it is necessary to do so in war, to subject yourself to these experiences, because that's not the battle you should pick, and that's not the moment you should show your hand. But when you do so, you undertake that with your eyes open and not in an unconscious and stupidly conforming manner. Concluding this briefing, one final comment I want to make about music, you know, soundtrack. I do some investigation on the internet, not much, and less all the time. But I have done a fair amount of investigation. That is to say, I've researched clips and documentaries that have been done by individuals, you know, who are like researching into 9/11 or whatever. And, for instance, in the Sandy Hook event, you see a great many YouTube clips posted to analyze this event. And I now have a rule that when I click on a YouTube event that has an interesting title where I think I might learn something, and I get a music track, I turn it off. I just turn it off. Because putting a music track to a YouTube clip that is intended to offer to the world some serious intel or to provide thoughtful and sober insight about a serious matter is absolutely unacceptable to me. It's as if your family had been murdered and a horrible massacre had taken place at your house and the house was burned down by fiends and criminals. And I investigated and I took films and I gathered together evidence and had interviews with witnesses and I put the whole package together and I brought it to you to explain to you, to show you, here, sit down. I have these photographs, I have this evidence, I have these testimonies, and I want to show you what happened to your family and your house. And excuse me for a minute, I'm going to go and turn over and put on a blasting heavy metal music or some angelic choruses from Wagner or some music from an electronic machine, some repetitive drum beats and some electronic track that I pulled off the internet. Can you imagine such a thing? It entirely discredits people, and I'm sorry to say that, because there are probably some people who have something genuine to offer, but they follow the unseen rule. You have to have Muzak. Why? Who made that rule? And now that I've said this, I'm sure you'll notice it even more if you haven't already, and you may take the same position that I take. I just can't stand it anymore. I don't want to hear music in the background. Do you remember Zeitgeist? Huh? That was an enormously influential piece of work. Terribly misleading piece of work. Terribly inaccurate in the first section of the analysis of the Christ myth. Deliberately misleading in many ways. It's a propaganda piece and a COINTEL piece. But you may remember that from the very first word and the very first frame of Zeitgeist, there was music playing in the background. I urge you, if you are someone who loads YouTube clips or any other type of personal investigation or documentary on the internet, I urge you not to use background music, unless in some specific way it relates to the content. So, I'll leave it there for the moment. Just want to remind you again of the little episode that began earlier, the little episode that happened earlier this evening, as I had completed the first talk, now briefing number 53. The Aeon Sophia does not need human assistance to produce her tulpa. But once it is produced, her highest desire is your command to what she does with it. And now, as she is preparing her tulpa, is the time to think about what you want her to do. What you want her to actually do. And we could say, you could say that there are two phases regarding us as her witnesses and allies. There are two phases in the production of her tulpa. One is to invoke the tulpa, and the other is to direct the tulpa. We're in the stage of invoking the tulpa. How do you do that? Just imagine what you say, what you want to say when the moment of command happens. What you want to command her to do. I can tell you, and this will come as no big surprise, that the planetary animal mother has murder on her mind. That doesn't surprise you, does it? It's time to really consider that her mind and your mind are the same. Or, to put it another way, that you and the planetary animal mother are of one mind. Has it ever crossed your mind, in a moment of rage and exasperation, that you would dearly love to terminate and whack some of the horrific human vermin who are threatening human society and harming the divine experiment on this planet? Has it ever occurred to you that you'd like to do that? Well, in the Calico War Party, you can have it both ways. You can actually do that, or you can command her to do it for you. And when you command her, in that final moment of command, you do it with the name of her seventh dreaming identity. But for now, we are just invoking the Tulpa. And to invoke the Tulpa, you use the name of Rigdon Labrow.